Ladies and gentlemen of Garage Logic, it's time for another segment of Author's Corner with Joe Souchere. Author's Corner.
Matt.
Sometimes it gets a little bit crazy.
Matt, you can stop that now. We have Vince Flynn with us. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
I won't apologize for Rook. You go back a long way with Rook.
Now,
we were sent an audio clip from the
Yes.
For the new book, The Last Man?
Yes, from the publisher.
You
so
aware
I don't even
this?
Think.
I was not aware of
yeah.
this.
Right. David Brown, he's your guy out in New York.
Yes.
I requested something from the audiobook, and this is what he sent me.
And now, from Author's Corner, here's an audio excerpt from Vince Flynn's new book, The Last Man.
I've been burned by you before, Ramp. Turn them over. Turn them over now, I say.
What, the plans?
My eggs. I said I wanted them over easy, you bastard!
That was an audio excerpt from The Last Man by Vince Flynn. We hope you enjoy the book.
Now, see, that comes along the lines of Mitch Rapp was a short order cook working at Plums on Snelling.
How long has he been trying to sell you that idea?
He's going
to
admit it someday.
Yeah, but is it an East Indian cook? I mean, what's going on here?
Well, that was the customer, and Mitch Rapp was the cook, and then he goes crazy.
I want
he
you to tune my eggs over now.
He wants to kill terrorists. That's you know, I'm glad you're riding on my coattail.
Which ethnic group were you trying to offend by that?
Yeah.
That's what
you
I want to know.
Tony Lee and I had a long meeting about that prior to, but we just decided on that voice.
How delayed is The Last Man?
What do you mean, delayed?
In other words, are you a bit behind schedule?
Oh, gosh, no. So the last book, Kill Shot, we had to move. I typically publish in the fall.
Right.
And so because I was going through radiation a year ago, starting in August, I just couldn't. I was in too much pain. B, I didn't have the energy, so we bumped that to February.
Okay.
Finished the radiation and felt great, finished that book, and then really kind of got ahead of the game on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did change the pub date by about 3 weeks because of the election.
All right.
We knew we did not want to be coming out anywhere near that election.
Right.
But we also want enough time between Christmas, so we ended up moving it to the week after the election.
How long typically does a book of yours stay in the New York Times top 10? A month, longer?
Oh, a couple months typically. Oh, it's top 15 is what's printed. Top 25 is what's on the internet. It's a couple months.
Yeah.
You know, we were the first. Mitch Rapp and myself.
Yeah.
You know, we were the first Simon & Schuster franchise to reach 1 million digital copies,
okay.
And that's up against Stephen King and Mary Higgins Clark and a lot of other people.
Right.
The books sell really well, and we've had this discussion, and you know a little bit about it from John. Depending on what time of the year that you publish, it's a vastly different landscape. Early on, I used to get published in spring or summer, and you know you can sell half of what you sell in November and be number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, it's like you've got DeMille comes out 1 week. And then you got Michael Conley and Baldacci and Grisham, and it's really
rough.
Well,
and the gal whose name escapes me, the
Patricia
Harry
Cornwell.
Harry Potter.
Yeah,
J.K. Rowling
is out with an adult novel that has nothing to do with.
Don't forget about Ms. Steele with the 50 Shades out there, huh?
No, that's true.
Well, but she's not. We don't go up against her.
Oh.
Fantastic. They do get stronger, and I detected in this book, The Last Man, which is not even available in stores until Tuesday.
Correct.
And someday you're going to explain to me why books are released on Tuesdays. It drives me crazy. I have no idea. I detected a completely different Mitch Rapp in this book. Is he becoming unhinged?
Well, I think he's actually becoming less unhinged. Now, you know, it's a little harder for me to keep all this stuff in perspective because the previous two books were prequels.
That's true.
And so, in my opinion, if you go back and you read Extreme Measures or Pursuit of Honor, he was more unhinged than he is in this book.
Okay.
The loss of his wife really had pushed him to the brink.
Well, as long as you brought that up, that was in Consent to Kill.
Correct.
That's six books ago.
Mm-hmm.
His wife was killed by a guy named Louis Gould. G-O-U-L-D.
Gould, yes.
Right. And I remember saying to you, and at the end of that book, was a very powerful ending. Mitch Rapp
finds. Well, yeah, I suppose we got to kind of give it
up. 6 books ago. What, am I ruined paperback sales?
No, wait a minute.
Huh? Vince, well, it's 6 books ago.
I typically don't like to talk about the endings of the books, but
all right,
ahead,
I won't
Joe,
then. I
go
won't.
Ahead.
So well, but I need to ask happens. You the
go
question.
Ahead, go ahead.
Mitch discovers at the end of the book, he finds Louis Gould, who's married, and they have a child. And he spares his life.
Spares the life
spares
of
the wife, the child, and Louis. Walks away. Mm-hmm. Knowing Louis could plug him in the back. Walks yep. down the beach. And I said to you at the time, this guy owes Mitch something.
Oh yeah.
He owes Mitch Rapp big time. And I'm not giving anything away by saying, and sure enough, Louis Gould appears in The Last Man.
Appears in this book, and I don't want to give away why he appears or what his motives are.
No, I won't do that.
Okay. But well, now I'm already on to the next book.
Right.
Which is always a problem because I don't want to give anything away.
No, don't.
But I think I can say this safely. You know, I've got plans for Louis Gould.
Okay.
Big plans.
And can we say this safely, that don't involve Rapp killing him? Or might that be the case?
That might be the case.
Okay, okay.
But I can tell you he's back in another book. He's back in the next book.
Did you bring those headphones with you?
No, I don't know.
From Victoria's Secret?
I don't know.
Nice curly headphones.
God almighty. Where did he get the white headphones?
I've never seen these
before. Look at those, Vince.
I saw them. I picked them up. I'm like, what?
Did you get a picture of him?
I thought Julia was in here using them. I literally.
Did you snap a picture of him, Reavers, in those?
Oh, God, yeah.
What are they?
Because we'll put that on Facebook. I think they're Corzo's Girlyman headphones.
Because they're not Patrick's.
No, they're very odd. Very odd. All right, let's.
They look like an Oompa Loompa or something. I don't know what the head.
You're battling cancer.
Yes.
And you have been
mm-hmm.
since
2 years ago and a week.
2010.
Found out 2 years ago and 1 week.
How were you able to write this doing what you're doing medically?
This one was easy. I wasn't I wasn't in any pain.
Okay.
I was in zero pain when I wrote this book. I felt good. You'll see something that I brought in today that I have never done for my any interview, let alone my inaugural Garage Logic interview.
Right.
I brought in my character summary.
No.
Down in Mexico with my wife. And she's, lovely Lisa's reading the advanced reader's copy, and she's usually pretty quiet about these, you know?
Mm-hmm.
She's the unexcitable Norwegian, and she's
right.
telling me, God, I think this is your best book. I love this character, and I'm thinking, okay, which character is that? Because I put this thing to bed back in August.
Yeah.
I've already moved on. I don't know if it's my age. I don't know if it's the hormone, you know, treatment they've got me on, but my memory is not what it used to be.
Really?
My brother Tim is telling me, I love this character. I'm thinking, who is
she?
Well,
was
she
talking about Mitch, obviously, or Louis Gould?
No. Other characters.
Okay.
Other minor characters
okay.
in the book, like Rickman and Joel Wilson, who
yes.
ends up being just obnoxious.
Oh, what
as
a
all.
Dreadful cur.
What about Ms. Hayek? I was hoping.
Ms. Hayek, yeah. Matt, it's going to happen. Something's. That's,
okay,
that's,
I'll
that's
keep
on
my
the
radar
wall.
Screen.
Yeah.
Quiet,
that's on the
Dan.
Radar screen. Yeah. But no, I felt great reading this book. You know, listen, I've got some side effects that are not, you know, they're not a joy to deal with every day. But, you know, back in October, we lost a good friend, Mike Nanny.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike and I were kind of, you know, faith buddies during our cancer treatments. And the guy never complained once.
Mm-hmm.
And he had his head cut open 3 times and did the chemo and the radiation. And, I mean, on and on and on. Never heard the guy complain
mm-hmm,
once.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, Mike's a huge inspiration. I look at how he handled it. And I think, you know, I've never had to spend a night in the hospital. They haven't cut me open. I take a lot of trips down to Mayo. You know, I go down and back
right.
and go back down the next day. And
you go see the Korean rock star down there?
he is the Korean rock star, by the way. Dr.
Yeah.
Eugene Kwon is absolutely amazing. But, you know.
Is the act of writing comforting?
Yes, I think it is. Lisa and I were just having that conversation, that it's good for me. Because
mm-hmm.
the problem with cancer is it can become all-encompassing. It can really take over your life. And the more time you're left sitting around wondering, is it growing? Is it shrinking? How do I feel today? It's just not good for you.
But if you get, you're writing a scene and you're really getting lost in it, are you completely lost in that moment? You're in the book.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Okay, so you're able to shut that out.
I'm able to shut it out.
Yeah.
You know, through through writing and prayer and, you know, great friends. And, yeah, you know, you get through the days. Some days are obviously not as good as others. Every time you go down for a scan,
right,
and they put you in the machine, and anybody who's ever had health issues will tell you this.
Right.
You always associate that scanning, that whatever the machine is, MRI, PET, whatever, you always associate it with the first time you found out the bad news.
Right.
So sometimes you go down and you get great news, and other times they say we're concerned, and you roll with it, and they change the treatment. Dr. Kwan, the Korean rock star, he likes to call it whack-a-mole.
Mm-hmm.
And so they stay in front of it, and when it starts to pop up, they'll tweak my treatments and whack it, and I've been lucky. You know, I'm 2 years into this thing, and I feel great.
And long-term prognosis is great.
Yeah.
You're clean right now.
I just started a new – well, clean as far as you could tell from the last scans.
The scan.
But there's microscopic stuff. Yeah. You never know. I mean – the cancer that I have, once it gets to the bones, it has a way of, let's say, going dormant. It gets suppressed, and then it finds a way to beat whatever the new drug is, and then it mutates, and then it comes back. And then you got to change drugs, mm-hmm. and you got to beat it down again.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the young guys, like prostate cancer, people think of, you know, their dads, their uncles, whoever. When guys get it in their late 30s, early 40s, it tends to be the more aggressive kind.
When were you in Mexico?
Just got back yesterday.
I was going to say, why do you look so good? You're tan, you're fit, you look like $1 million.
Well,
and you always have throughout this. Is that a peculiarity of the form of disease you have, I wonder?
I made some serious changes. I haven't had red meat in, you know, a year and a half.
Okay.
Cut out dairy as much as I can, sugar as much as I can, a lot of stuff like that. You know, a lot of organic fruits and vegetables,
mm-hmm.
Just stuff to try to give me the edge, try to work out more. It's part of the, if you're going to beat this thing, I think you got to have, it's got to be body, mind, and soul with mm-hmm. great medical care. You mm-hmm. can't just throw it up to the doctors and say, you guys do all the heavy lifting. I'm just going to sit here and take whatever drug you give me.
Right.
So you try to stay healthy. Attitude helps. And mm-hmm. prayer. We live in an age now. You know, I was bummed out a couple of weeks ago when the poll came out and it said, 20% of the people in this country now don't have faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
it's higher than that.
It might be higher than that, but at least that's what the poll said. And listen, everybody's different, but I can tell you, there's no way I could have got through the last 2 years without faith,
mm-hmm.
and without Lisa,
mm-hmm.
and some close friends who. You know, like I got a great guy, Ed Kasurik, who, mm-hmm. you know, is a father of eight, lives out in Mendota Heights, and I know him from St. Thomas Academy. He has been my spiritual mentor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get a text from him, you know, have you prayed today? Have you gone to the Adoration Chapel? Have mm-hmm. you done whatever? And I can't tell you the gift it is to have people like that, because it does give you a great sense of calm.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you know, and Joe, listen, we're alike in a couple of ways. One is we're paranoid as all heck.
Right.
We got these imaginations.
I don't know where you get that.
If you...
what do you hear, is there?
If you can't... If you... You know, it's very easy to look at the dark side. It's mm-hmm. very easy to sit there and imagine your own funeral, and it sucks.
Yeah.
So you have to stay positive. And because of friends like that and a lot of faith... you know, I'm not telling you every day is fantastic, but pretty much every day I get out of bed and say, you know, mm-hmm. thank you, Lord, for life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still kicking.
Who gets advanced uncorrected proofs to read? I did in this case. Rookie did. Who gets these typically?
Media.
Yep.
That'd be you guys. And then they sent me 10. Most of them go to family members, close friends, stuff like that.
What editing process takes place to correct all of the stuff I would have typically found in an uncorrected proof?
A copy editor goes through that manuscript two more times, as well as my editor goes through it two more times. Because
mm-hmm.
they're loaded with mistakes.
Oh, sure.
But we have, we've had Matt probably doesn't catch very many of them.
I just found it funny that dealing with dyslexia, he gives away everything at the front, and then he works his way toward the back.
No, that really isn't the way it works.
No, it's not?
No,
okay.
No. That answered my question, because obviously when they hit the stands, they're clean as hell.
Well, pretty clean.
Yeah,
I have a history of, you know, my editor, My editor says I've screwed her up because of my dyslexia. I've taught her how to spell words in ways she'd never imagined possible. But we hand these in on such tight deadlines.
Right.
You know, we hand them in, and they go to the printer like 8 weeks later.
Right.
And I'm usually at my cabin, or this time I was at the cabin, and then I was back. I missed Lisa and the kids too much, so I was back at the house. And the last couple of weeks, you know, I am. Mm-hmm. It's from 7 in the morning till 10 at night. I'm just pounding away.
Right. Because you have a deadline on the next one.
Well, and if I don't get this in at a certain date, they have to move the pub.
Okay.
Causes a lot of problems.
Right.
So, no, you want to get it done. You want to get paid, and you want to move on to the next one.
Will you do a tour for this book?
Small. I'm going to go to New York just to do some media.
Mm-hmm.
But those days are probably, you know, because of my health issues back in February, I did not tour.
Right.
And my sales were up.
For Killshot.
For Killshot.
In other words, you found it didn't have that big of an impact.
I think once you get to a certain level, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem for me is health-wise. Every single tour I ever went on, I would... Either in the middle of the tour or when the tour was done, I was wiped out and sick as a dog.
Right. Well, bad food, bad hotels.
Oh, and you're getting up at 4 a.m. in the wrong time zone to jump on a plane.
Right.
To, you know, and it just it never ends, and you're shaking 1,000 hands. And I don't know how these politicians do it.
No, I don't either. I said earlier I detected a different Mitch, and you corrected me. I have another way to explore that, and I'd like to explore it when we come back. Vince, we have just a few moments before we cut away at the bottom, and you mentioned Nelson DeMille. Do you read him?
I do.
I'm reading the new one. When I finished your book, I started his new one, The Panther.
Panther, yep.
How does he get away with what he gets away with?
I do not know.
It's 700 pages long.
Yeah.
I happen to like it, but he makes you work.
He does make you work, and I think his writing style has changed a little bit. Yeah. One of his things is, you know, Nelson typically writes in the first person, which allows you to be far more humorous because you get inside the character's head and they can be a smart aleck. I haven't tried to do that yet, and I don't know if I ever will because I do think it takes a certain talent, and I'm not sure I have it.
Oh, it's just aside after aside after aside and one-liners, and I happen to enjoy it, but I can see where a lot of people might bail on it and say, I can't do it.
Yeah, and I think it's anytime you're in my genre and you go over 450, 500 pages, you're running a risk.
Yeah, I agree. Now, General Petraeus.
Well, we got to save that for when we come back from the break.
Oh, we will, but I want your thoughts on this.
Before, I got to plug Movember.
Yeah.
You guys have a team, right?
Yeah, it's going on right now.
Yeah, and we want to take you on, bro.
Yeah.
So Thomas Patrick Tracy, my best friend since my freshman year in high school. He started a team last year, Mitch Rapp and the Killer Mustaches.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, but can he beat this? Vince, turn around.
No, nobody can beat that.
But look at that. Look at that one from yesterday.
I know,
huh?
Matt. I don't know if you're using Miracle-Gro or what, but that thing is.
It's like a Chia Pet.
It's Chia Pet.
It's a pet rock. Yes.
Although I think he got a jump start on the deal. I don't think he shaved for about a week before it started.
No, give me that, Flynn.
General Petraeus, you know him personally.
Yeah.
He resigned today. Claiming an affair. Does that make sense to you?
So two things pop through my head right away. The first is that...
head of the CIA.
Head of the CIA. He is... I got a call. I was down in Florida a couple years ago, and it's always funny when these guys get your cell phone because I don't give it out to very many people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his aide-de-camp saying... Introduced himself and said, listen, you know, the next time you're in D.C., the general would love to sit down and have dinner. And this is when he was running the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, sure, that'd be great. I think I'll be there. And I gave him a date and worked it out. And the two of us sat down for about 2 hours at a hotel in Washington and headed out. And it was one of, and I don't share this story very often. Maybe today I will a little bit because of, you know, I don't know. But it was one of the strangest encounters I've ever had with another person.
In what sense?
In the sense that we got into basically an argument over, because I'm trying to figure out why does he want to meet with me?
Was he a reader?
He's a reader.
Mm-hmm.
And his staff, you know, everybody reads. You know, he is an intellectual. There's no doubt about it. But I'm trying to, I want to say this without being too offensive, but I don't think there's any way to avoid it. I think the guy's, it's a fairly good bet he's a narcissist. But most of those guys are. I mean, you don't rise to the level of being a four-star general and running a theater of war unless you're pretty darn confident and you're very, you know, aggressive and somewhat selfish. I mean, there's exceptions, of course. But he, you know, during the course of the dinner, I'm trying to figure out why. What does he want from me? Does he want a signed book? Does he want a photo? What's going on here? And what I came to the conclusion that he did not like the fact that I was giving his guys maybe some bad ideas. Because he's a real stickler, and I was shocked when he became director of the CIA because of this. He's very adamant that the military should be handling all this stuff over there. He doesn't like the black ops stuff. And our argument basically centered, this is one thing that's great about how my parents raised me. No better or no less than anybody you're ever going to meet. So it allows me to sit down with a guy like Petraeus, and I'm impressed, of course, but at the same time, I'm not going to roll over.
Right.
And so he starts telling me, you know, I just want you to know that's not how we do things, you know, in your book. And I said, well, I beg to differ, General. I know some other examples of where we have done things like this. You know, we're going back and forth, and he's pretty strong-willed about the deal. And I said, General, you know, let's just take a step back. From a moral standpoint, I fail to see the difference between you take a former Navy SEAL sharpshooter and have him shoot a guy, a known terrorist, in the back of the head in Istanbul, versus, you know, firing a Hellfire missile from a Predator drone into a mud hut in Afghanistan. He said, there's a huge difference. I said, the only difference I see is that in Istanbul, you don't kill the guy's family along with him. You just take out the one bad guy. And he's going, no, no, that's not how it works. You know, these are approved targets, and it's in a theater of war. And I'm just going, man, this guy is really locked in. He's obsessed on this deal. And I left the meeting literally thinking that this is the strangest dinner I have ever had in my life with somebody.
It does sound like it.
Because there's a lot more to it, and I don't necessarily want to get into it, because a lot of times most of these meetings I have, I try to honor. You know, like with the meetings I had with President Bush one-on-one, I don't talk about what we discussed at the time.
But does it make sense that the head spook in the world?
No, it doesn't.
Suddenly goes in and says, oh, I think I'm going to resign. I had an affair.
So here's the second thing.
What's
that
the deal?
The first thing that popped into my mind was, well, I already knew the guy was a narcissist, because after that meeting, I followed up with some people I knew, and they were like, this guy's been full of himself since he was at West Point and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I looked into it. So then the next thing that pops in my mind is Benghazi.
Right.
Because I'm telling you right now, here's what's going to come out on the Benghazi deal. And this is me knowing how the Situation Room operates and these guys. What we're going to find out is that they tried to do this thing on the cheap. They didn't want to get the military involved, and so what they basically did during when the you-know-what was hitting the fan, they turned to the CIA and they said, you know, roll out the bags of cash and go find the closest militia with some big guns and, you know, trucks, and pay them to roll up on these two buildings and stop these attacks.
Right.
Well, you know what? When you outsource your security to groups like that, the negotiations can all, you know, it's the middle of the night. How you start to get all these guys out of bed? It's not like you're calling in Delta Force or SEAL Team 6.
Hold that thought. Vince Flynn is with us. The book is The Last Man. We'll be back in just a moment. This might pertain to Petraeus, but I want to just get back to the book for a moment and make an observation, and you can either corroborate it or tell me I'm wrong. But in The Last Man, it strikes me that Mitch Rapp has as many American enemies as he would face in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's like fighting a two-front war.
What he must negotiate with the backstabbers and the people in Washington who want an accounting of the bag money and the black ops, and it's just amazing how he threads that needle. And you seem to know too much about it, to tell you the truth.
Well, you know,
I'm surprised Petraeus hasn't come to your door.
I sit, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to these guys about their frustrations. And more often than not, they're not frustrated with Al-Qaeda, because that's a defined enemy, okay? And so they're after them, they're trying to kill them. They're not frustrated with the Taliban. They're the enemy, they're trying to kill them. They're frustrated with their own support people back in Washington. They're frustrated that they have an attorney general that wants to indict them for doing something that the previous administration said was completely legal, and these guys put their cojones on the line.
Right.
And they were, and we, and by the way, we've had this discussion before. Listen, extreme measures, extraordinary measures, waterboarding, what have you, done properly, it works.
Mm-hmm.
And we would have never got Bin Laden if the previous administration hadn't started this process by playing rough with some of these
right.
guys. And I know, you know, some of your callers always get, your listeners get upset about this, but I refuse to get too upset if, let's say, in a given year, we capture four of the worst terrorists in the world and we make them listen to Barney all night long mm-hmm. and make them think they're drowning.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kind of guys that we just found out, you know, they go shoot 14-year-old girls in the head because they want to go to school.
Right.
They're the most horrible people on the planet right
yeah,
now.
They're evil.
Next to sexual, you know, pedophiles.
Yep.
They are the absolute worst people on the planet, and they're not going to put on a uniform, and they're not going to, you know, they intentionally target civilians. So mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I just don't think you play by the same set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so these guys go lay it all on the line. They spend months and months away from their family. This is how they're treated. The FBI knocks on their door. The Justice Department comes after them. This is all real-world stuff that I thread into these books to try to make them compelling.
Well, is there some real-world application here for what Petraeus might be going through? Was somebody going to blow the whistle on him? Was it blackmail? What?
Listen, you go, you know, you put yourself in the mind of first of all, you can be a four-star general and have an affair and try to hide it. And if you get caught, you might even survive it. But not as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
You can. This is what people forgot about the Clinton deal, or they tried to, you know, rush it under the rug. Was he opened himself up to blackmail?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Clinton story that I always tell that I had verified was, you know, everybody knows they were having phone sex. Well, yeah. Guess what? His phone was secure. Yeah. She's talking on a cordless phone
right.
at the Watergate apartment complex. So I find out years later. I hear this rumor. I go to somebody at Langley. I start asking them. They said. Yeah, the Israelis got a recording of it.
Really?
Damn yep. it, is that what happened? Those damn Israelis. I thought I was having
and
fun
then
with
they,
those guys.
And then they brought it. They brought it to the White House.
Uh-huh.
I've had the whole meeting described to me.
Oh.
This thing is classic. They bring it to the White House, and they're like, we apologize. This was picked up accidentally, but we just thought you guys might want to have a copy of it.
Oh, for God's sake. Honest to God.
Yeah, they sure
you can't
did bring
make it up. You no. can't make this
no,
stuff
you
up
really
fast
can't.
Enough.
You can't. So Petraeus was in this horrible situation then
yeah.
of setting himself up to be in a similar situation.
Well,
he has to
wonder,
leave, right?
Was it a subordinate? Was it a foreign asset? Who knows what it was? Did this come about because somebody was going to have to take the fall for Benghazi, and they're about to make the CIA take the fall, and Petraeus is now somebody, he's so sullied now. How does he stand up and so Benghazi? Let's go back to that night. All right.
Yep.
This is what happens in Washington, 5 o'clock East Coast time. All of these various groups, state, DOD, which is defense, and many, many more, CIA and the White House. They all have situation rooms or op centers that are manned 24/7, and you end up with an ambassador who's all of a sudden in an attack like this. Everybody knows immediately.
I watch Homeland.
All those but it's not just one op center,
yep.
it's all of them.
Right.
They all know with practically real time.
Okay.
And the National Security Advisor or Deputy National Security Advisor knows within almost real time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, unless the president is sitting down with someone like Putin, they're coming into the Oval Office. They're walking over to the residence. They're going to wherever he is, and they're saying, Mr. President, we have an issue. We need, you know, we don't think you don't have to come down to the Situation Room quite yet. But we want to make you aware of this, and it's an all hands on deck kind of thing. And they all coalesce together. So Petraeus would have been at the op center at Langley. Secretary of State Clinton would have been at the op center at the State Department, and what's his name would have been over at Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have all been watching it. And it's very likely. And I'm shocked that the media hasn't asked these questions.
I think the media is useless.
They are because within an hour. You know, Panetta at Defense and Clinton at State, which are really close, they would have been at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good chance that Petraeus came in as well, and they were all down in the Situation Room, just like what happened, you know, during the Bin Laden raid. But they had time to set all that up in advance. But these guys would have come in with just a handful of their people, and they would have sat down in the Situation Room to try to manage this thing. And I think what happened was The first mistake was that they denied security going back to August when they reduced the staff. The second mistake was that they did not have a military contingency in place to go in if something like this happened. And so what they did that night was they should have ran two avenues of a solution. And the first avenue should have been, let's spin up a quick reaction force in Italy and get them ready to go just in case. Because I think what they were thinking is, this thing isn't going to last 7 hours. So they didn't get that going, that ball going quick enough. What they relied on, and this is me guessing and then talking to some people, they relied on the CIA to go use their assets to go take bags of cash, wake up local militia commanders, and say, get your people out of bed, load up your trucks with your machine guns on the back, and get over to the consulate and the safe house and end this thing.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get people to move fast enough.
Right.
And at no point did we decide to arm a drone or take an F-16 or an F-18. You know, we got a lot of planes all over the world that could have been there within an hour or two.
Right.
And we never moved on it.
Well, should blame ultimately be assigned for this? And to whom?
Benghazi?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that was always my biggest gripe post 9/11 was no one got fired.
Yeah.
No one got fired.
Right.
And I thought, you know, gone are the days, like in the United States Navy, I remember about 5 years before 9/11, a captain was bringing a ship into Norfolk, and he went to sleep.
Yeah.
It was the middle of the night. He said, XO, you've got the bridge. Well, they ran the thing about onto a sandbar.
Right.
And guess what? When
he
the tug
got fired.
Yeah. No, he resigned.
Yeah.
The tug showed up, and he, you know, relieved himself of command and got
right
off the thing.
Right.
There's no more shame. You know, the people that turned down the FISA warrants at 9/11, none of those people got fired. The people who turned down the request for security at state should be fired. The people who didn't come up with a contingency plan, they should be fired, primarily at state.
We'll wrap this up. Vince Flynn has to leave. He's got an important high school football game
to get
to.
Yeah, what's your prediction?
Just a moment. Hang on to that prediction.
And now, from Author's Corner, here's an audio excerpt from Vince Flynn's new book, The Last Man.
I've been burned by you before, Ramp. Turn them over. Turn them over now, I say.
What, the plans?
My eggs. I said I wanted them over easy, you bastard!
That was an audio excerpt from The Last Man by Vince Flynn. We hope you enjoy the book.
Lisa Coppy wants to thank you, Vince. You sent all of your books to her Marine, and she's entirely grateful. And I'll leave
that's,
you with
it's a lot of fun
I'll
doing
leave
that.
You with
we
that
get
email.
These we get these notes from these guys. You know, they're over there, and the gal serving, and you know, it's fun. Mm-hmm. They need some guys to take their mind off this stuff.
Have you been to Afghanistan?
No, I know John was over there a couple years ago.
You don't want to go now.
No, Lisa wasn't a big fan of it, and. You know, pretty busy with the kids and trying to find the time. And I the closest I got, I went over to Jordan and spent a week over there and did some stuff with
the
special
forces.
Aren't
you buddies with the king?
I was over there as a guest of the king.
a guest of the king.
I will say this, you know, the meeting I had with Petraeus was one of the strangest meetings I've ever had. The king is like, it's like you and I. It's like Garage Logic. He wants to sit down and have a beer, talk about Harleys. I mean, he's the most normal guy in the world.
We can
something?
Go on remote over there. We can bring the show over there, can't we?
No.
Go
no.
see the king?
No,
hey, king.
No, we'd have to get a personal invite. There'll be no local appearances that
no,
I know
but
of.
I signed books at Once Upon a Crime, so they've got a couple hundred on stock. I signed about 1,500 for Barnes & Noble, so the local B&Ns will all have stock, but... no public appearances, trying to stay healthy and keep that immune system pumped up.
Will your Tommy's win tonight?
I'm hoping. I'm not exactly the most unbiased person to ask.
All right.
Best of luck with your health and this book. 1500 ESPN is KSTP St. Paul, Minneapolis. Vince Flynn has joined us. It's been a great custom that GL gets the first interview
always
for each Mitch Rapp book, and we appreciate it. The Last Man will be in bookstores this coming Tuesday.